supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Shakespeare on the Couch and the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater. I'm Larry Roebling. Today, Dr. Dan has a therapy session with Hamlet and the theater's founder and artistic director, Carmen Kahn, who has directed over 50 Shakespeare plays, joins the conversation. Dr. Dan and actor Josh Kaknich, who plays Hamlet, improvise a therapy session. First, a little overview of the play, and then let's listen into Hamlet's session.
Hamlet has been having a difficult time lately, so I'll see if some counseling might be helpful. As part of the process, he'll share a few of his monologues during the session so that I can get to know him better. But before I do, let's get Carmen Kahn to give us a quick overview of the key plot points we'll be discussing. Carmen?
Hamlet has just come home to Elsinore Castle in Denmark from university because his father has died suddenly and his mother, Queen Gertrude, has very quickly married his uncle Claudius. Later, Hamlet is then visited by the ghost of his father, who tells him that his uncle has murdered him. Hamlet struggles to know if this is true or not, and he gets the idea of doing a play in front of his uncle, the alleged murderer, thinking his uncle will feel so guilty that he will accidentally reveal himself. Finally, we'll hear what is probably considered to be one of the most famous speeches in Hamlet, possibly in all of literature. Hamlet contemplates suicide here, but he knows he's being spied on by his uncle and another character in the play, Polonius. And we can surmise that he's not really suicidal, but he does feel these things very deeply.
So, Hamlet, welcome to my office. What do you prefer I call you? Hamlet, Prince Hamlet?
Hamlet is fine.
I want to see if I can be helpful. In order to do it, I need to get to know you better.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I'm really curious about your initial reaction when you heard about your father's death and your mother's, I would imagine, premature marriage to your uncle.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. Oh, God! God, but 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. Let me not think on't. Frailty, thy name is woman. Why, she? Oh, God, a beast that wants discourse of reason would have mourned longer. Married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month she married. Almost wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot come to good. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue.
That's helpful, Hamlet. You referred to your mother as sleeping between incestuous sheets. Now, I could hear in your voice grief near tears and the rage at the same time. That makes all the sense in the world. But what is it like to experience your mother as laying between those incestuous sheets?
I find it painful to imagine my mother, who appeared to love my father so dearly, and whom I know my father loved dearly, would so quickly throw away that wonderful, beautiful, and cherished relationship for another man who is so far inferior to my father.
I wonder what this woman was like before you left for university. Was she warm? Was she caring and compassionate? Or was she cold and in hindsight, a sense that she might be conniving?
I never would have thought that she was capable of this. I did not perceive her as conniving or deceitful or capable of anything like this. No, I found her warm and her presence comforting, and that I could trust her and confide in her. I suppose that the fear of losing a kingdom or losing her status, losing her safety, led her to the decision that she made that assured her that those things would not change.
That's great compassion for a woman that you're clearly enraged at, a woman who betrayed you.
Because of how dearly I cherish her, that is why it pains me so deeply that she would throw that away, that she would disregard her care for her husband and for her relationship to me as a son, for trying to replace the role of father with not even a stranger, but my uncle, someone who I already had an established familial relationship with. I'm sorry.
What's that emotion? Is it tears? Rage? Tell me.
Confusion, frustration, outrage even. But as I said, I must hold my tongue. That is what bothers me the most, that I cannot speak these things because of my station, because of my relationship to my mother, because my uncle is now the king. I cannot speak out of turn. I cannot say anything that would be perceived as rude or impetuous or... I must maintain a composure that is worthy of the Prince of Denmark.
Hamlet, say what you really would have said if you didn't have to hold your tongue. What was in your heart and mind?
My uncle had just made a grand show of his mourning for my father's death and the surprise that it was that my mother agreed to marry him so quickly. He had been working at her for months, years. And there was no love lost between he and my father. That smiling villain.
We have to underscore, and I do as a psychologist, that to lose both parents in this way, you're a young man. You're just home from university. To lose both parents in this way, through death and deceit, is a significant trauma. And we know now in the research, trauma affects the brain. It affects the way the brain learns and experiences things. If you're just joining us, this is Voices in the Family Special. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're taking poetic license here in our ongoing Shakespeare on the Couch series. And actor Josh Kaknich, as Hamlet, meets me in my therapy office. Hamlet, you, at one point, you feigned madness. So I have to wonder, was all of it feigned? And when you did feign madness, at some point, did you actually feel mad? Tell us what it was like on the inside.
You know, they say that if you pretend to be something for long enough, you find yourself actually becoming that thing.
Therefore the question.
Yes. At first, I found it freeing that I could free myself from responsibility, from the repercussions of anything that I might say that would offend or confuse or confound in any way, because I could write it off as madness. But as my actions began to carry more weight, things that I could not undo with words, like killing a man with my own hands, I couldn't even react to that in the way that I wanted, and so I retreated into the hole, the safety of my insanity, because I didn't want to face the consequences of what I had done. And I don't know that I have.
It is safe in there, isn't it? It's safer than guilt or shame or murderous rage. It's much safer than these very, very uncomfortable feelings.
It's not that I don't feel those. It's just that if I were to react in the way that someone who was sane normally would, then I give up the game, and so I need to continue pretending.
Right. So let's talk about Ophelia. The woman you loved dearly and deeply is being manipulated to sit in a room, ostensibly reading a book, knowing that you'll be coming to that room. This after you haven't seen her in a very long time because her father convinced her to reject you. So as you entered the room, you knew you were being spied on. So what did you say?
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To die, to sleep, no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy take, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin? Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourn no traveler returns, puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of? Thus conscience does make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and moment with this regard their currents turn awry and lose the name of action.
Hamlet, those words may well have been meant for Claudius and Ophelia's father, Polonius. Even if it was partly for their ears, you could have said anything, anything. And yet, you raise the possibility of your own suicide. So, unless you really do struggle with whether or not you do deserve to live.
It was a calculated tool to have them wonder whether or not I would take my life. Means that they will not question any of my behaviors from this time forward. And yet, as you said, the thought must come from somewhere. Yes, I have wondered whether it would be easier to not be alive, not to take my own life, but simply for it to end, to not be faced with the decision that I have to make. And there is a difference between wanting to take one's own life and wanting one's own life to end. So yes, while it began as a useful tool born of a initially desperate contemplation, I found an intriguing thought within my own statement, leading to the question of what comes after death. And that was not for the ears of those observing me. That was a genuine contemplation, a genuine question. In that moment, I think I truly was alone.
Did you, in fact, choose life, or did you postpone that decision?
Honestly, my stream of thought was cut off by the entrance of the woman I love. And so I did postpone the answer to that question.
You're not alone, Hamlet. So many of us do. Hamlet, I see we're running out of time, and I think this meeting has been very helpful for me, and I hope it has for you. I hope in some way I've given you at least a modicum of understanding, maybe even peace. That's my wish.
You're listening to Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, who has just improvised a therapy session with actor Josh Kaknich playing Hamlet. Today's special was taped with a live audience in WHYY Studio 2, and we'll hear from them later in the show. Coming up, our actor breaks character, and the director joins us as the three discuss Hamlet as everyman. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back.
I felt so much enrolled that I was tempted to charge you.
I'm Larry Roebling. We're back with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, who just put Shakespeare on the couch. Hamlet and Dr. Dan finished therapy. Now, actor Josh Kaknich steps into his own skin and is joined with the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater's executive director, Carmen Kahn. They examine the session and this complex character known as Hamlet.
Josh, let's start with you. I imagine what we did was actually the first time you were in therapy as Hamlet. Just a guess.
Yes, that was my first therapy session in character.
I'm curious. Are you going to call me back?
You know, I might. That was actually very intriguing.
What was it like going through that in character?
Man. Wild. When you take on a character, you're, especially in Shakespeare, you're informed by the text. So you have your interactions with people and your thoughts are literally scripted. So going off-road in that way was really exciting. At first, you know, the gears were kind of turning where I was like, oh man, all right, so based on what I know of Hamlet, what would he say here? And I was, you know, pulling from other areas of the text. I'm not sure where the turn happened, but like I started having this nervous tick with my hands and I was pressing on things, actually considering these questions as myself, but also as Hamlet. It was fascinating.
Do you think Hamlet is going to feel different to you going forward?
I think that Hamlet will feel fuller moving forward, now having new things to ponder and consider, yes.
So I want to ask you both. There are many human themes, and powerful ones, that run throughout this. We heard almost all of them. Let's start with betrayal. I mean, my, that runs rampant throughout this play. You know, you're starting with your mother and then your childhood friends, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, were manipulated. Ophelia was manipulated. Why, Carmen, why do you think betrayal was such a central theme here?
The thing that I'm amazed at and as I was listening here, struck again by how Shakespeare can take those huge themes like betrayal and love and fate and make them so human. And I think that's the, I mean, betrayal is part of our lives and it's a universal thing. Everyone has betrayed or been betrayed. And yet the way he does it, you relate to it so personally in this play. I'm not sure exactly what Shakespeare had in mind in terms of his personal, why he wrote that. But again, it's like Hamlet's not a character, and Shakespeare's characters are not characters so much as people. And they're really complex. As you said, Hamlet berates himself terribly, and yet he's inaccurate about that because he's actually doing a really good job of taking the time, taking the care to find out if the ghost is true. And yet he's, am I a coward? I'm terrible. I'm a rogue. I'm a peasant slave. Like, don't we do that all the time? It's like, we're doing pretty well, but we kind of beat up on ourselves. Mm. So I think that's what I was struck by, the sort of how he makes it so personal, but there are these huge archetypal themes.
This business of betrayal just flips your life upside down. Once you thought was true is no longer true. Any married person or a person in a significant long-term relationship whose partner had an affair. I mean, universally, you hear the words, I thought I knew you. Mm. Now I don't know who you are. It just turns your life upside down. Or any child who learns the same about a parent or a parental divorce. It just, who am I now?
Yeah.
You know, what is my truth? And there you are, living in the middle of all of that. I mean, I wonder what that's like for Hamlet, for you as an actor.
Hmm.
There's no there. There's nothing to touch.
Well, for Hamlet, he at least has Horatio, the friend that he meets at the beginning of the play and who he ultimately asks with his dying breath to clear his name, to tell his story truthfully. Looking at this from like a writer's perspective, it's fun to set that up, to say, you know, oh, if we're going to have this dynamic moment of him, you know, dying in this person's arm at the end, then we need to set up that relationship from the beginning so the audience knows, oh, we can trust this person and we like them. And then going through and having his other friends who show up betray him, this girl who he professes his love to and through conversation of other characters we learn is intended to marry, betray him, having his mother at the beginning marrying someone else, betray him. You know, it's like every possible instance of this, you know, cutting all the threads that are holding Hamlet's world together, it's dynamic and interesting to watch, and it opens the doors for a lot of questions that, you know, you can bring up within the play. But as the actor, you're losing control of all these things. The wonderful thing about Shakespeare is that you always have the audience. And so even while you're losing your mind and, you know, finding your world falling apart, you can look straight out and interact with all of the faces out there and say, do you see what's happening? Please help me understand. It's that awesome question that, like, some people in real life, oh, everyone else looks so put together. Everyone else, you know, seems that they have it under control. So I can't ask them that question. But here in the world of the play, you can go to hundreds, maybe thousands of other people all at the same time and say, how do I deal with this?
That really highlights the difference, one difference anyway, between you and Hamlet. And that is, you look to these strangers mm-hmm. and presume kindness. He would not have, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I'm a very trusting actor. When you're doing a show, of course you want people to be interested and entertained. But this show requires a level of trust any of the shows where, you know, the leading character has soliloquies where it's just, you know, them on the stage talking with the audience requires a level of trust. And so trust them. Give the audience the benefit of the doubt from the very beginning.
I want to talk about desire, which is also a theme in the play. Mostly what we see are the most obvious are Claudius and Gertrude's desire for power at any cost. We know, and Shakespeare really points it out, that this lust for power is a grand delusion that it buys security. It's a delusion because what we know is the opposite is true. We learn it from Hamlet, and we learned it from Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. But we keep coming back. We keep coming back to desire that is out of control. Carmen?
I guess I have a slightly different opinion of Gertrude. I think she's epically unaware. I feel like she's, from the text and some of the things that she says, that she's kind of gullible and has let Claudius talk her into. Even though Hamlet is the rightful heir, you know, his father's died, he should be king next. But I think, you know, Claudius is such a schemer. She's not so much a power grabber as someone who's kind of the victim of his power grabbing. Because later on, when Hamlet speaks to her in the closet scene, she doesn't realize. But then she understands. She's like, oh, okay, all right, I believe you that he did this. And then she's on Hamlet's side.
Josh?
I think that I've been making a lot of my judgments about Gertrude based off of the actress who is currently playing her. Based on the arc of the story that we have, I do trust her. I mean, it does pain me when I find out that, you know, my father has been betrayed not only by his brother who killed him, but also by his wife who could have been in cahoots. He still wants to hold on to this remnant of his old world, the old life that he knew, where he trusted his mother. But ultimately, I don't think that she has conniving or ill intentions. I think that, you know, like a lot of us, we make bad choices because we want to be comfortable.
We probably make all choices because we want to be comfortable. The search for well-being is ultimately what we're looking for. Carmen, this Hamlet guy that we're getting to know best we can. Here's a guy that feels compassion for his mother who betrayed him. And here's a guy that loves the love of his life so much that he sends her away. Here's a guy that is capable of deep love and loyalty to his father, that he's willing to do anything to honor his father's legacy. And yet he sees nothing of that in himself. Just sees what he's done wrong. It is really, on a personal level, to me, it's heartbreaking.
Yes, I agree with you. And something we talked about at the beginning of rehearsal, that after all of this time of directing these different versions of Hamlet, it kind of occurred to me, which happens with Shakespeare's plays, was the incredible capacity for love that Hamlet has, and that everything is out of love with him. And I thought that was really revealing, and I think has to drive the play, and I think drives Josh's performance. And so we're with him all the way. It's like it's so painful. It's almost like he's way too sensitive for this world.
I know, as a psychologist and one who studied what it means to be human, if you went into this self-confident, your audience wouldn't be with you. You know, it's your tender, open, broken heart that draws us in. Couldn't have worked any other
way. Yes, absolutely.
I look at all the psychological themes here, mm-hmm. all of them dark. We don't know much about the author's childhood. What we do know is that he had twin sons.
It was a twin son and daughter.
Son and daughter, my mistake. One of those twins died at age 11. What we don't know is what impact that might have had on Shakespeare, his thinking, his worldview. We don't know that. Mm. It's, as a psychologist, and I'm sure I'm not alone, you have to wonder, you know, and how did this affect his writing and the outcomes of most of his plays?
Yes, because the timing of it, his son died around the same time. Well, he died in around 1596, and the play was written in 1601, and also Shakespeare's father died at the same time. So, as you said, Hamlet is about great loss. So we can only speculate that that was part of it. I mean, how could it not be? When every artist has, you know, his works out of what they know.
We talk about how it was so much more common back then, but still not to the individual.
Right, yeah.
You know, this only happened to me. And very common for a parent to feel guilt, usually irrational, grief, anger. And here we are in Hamlet. He writes it and produces it right in the midst of his grief. Mm. It's, you know, 4 or 5 years. So one has to wonder. How many times have you directed this play?
I've directed Hamlet 3 times on our main stage, and then we do a high school tour, which Josh is in right now. He's playing Hamlet, and I've directed that 3 times.
How has your view of Hamlet developed over the years?
Oh, I feel every time I approach it, it's like I'm a student again, because there are so many layers and layers to it. I'm now of the opinion it's a real coming-of-age story, and one of the things I think that especially high school students, teenagers relate to is Hamlet has been given this huge, huge burden, and he has no way of knowing how to deal with it. He doesn't know how to navigate it. He's just swimming without a raft, you know. And I think that that's a very... That really connects with adolescents, I think, a lot. That's why they love the play.
And that's what he was. Basically, just past his adolescence, he was in college, 19
Yes,
years
yeah,
old,
exactly. So. He was an adolescent.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
This is a Voices in the Family special, Shakespeare on the Couch. Coming up next, what did our studio audience think? They get a chance to talk with Dr. Dan, actor Josh Kaknich, and Carmen Kahn, who directs the current tour of the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater's production of Hamlet. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back.
Remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain! Fie upon it, foe!
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Larry Roebling. Today, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has once again paired up with the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater for a counseling session with one of the Bard's best-known tormented characters, Hamlet. Our studio audience has some thoughts.
Thinking in new ways about Hamlet, and it occurred to me that children don't like to think of their parents as sexual beings. What may have happened, and I'm beginning to believe that Hamlet is Shakespeare's most sexual play. Even Romeo and Juliet was fresh love. And the one that I always thought was the sexiest play was Antony and Cleopatra. But this one has implications of sexuality. And the whole idea that Gertrude was a faithful wife, but perhaps longed for more. Her husband seems to have been such a good king and a good man. I'm getting the feeling that Claudius was a very sexy guy and had really seduced Gertrude, who was perhaps feeling a little bit starved sexually.
Well, as I listen to you, I'm sitting next to Hamlet,
yes,
hearing you, and let me be the first report. He actually did go mad just now, hearing that possibility about dear old mommy.
Yes.
It's an interesting perspective. I thank you. Carmen, Josh, yeah, you want to comment?
I mean, it is an interesting perspective, and there are lots of thoughts about plays that have interesting perspectives like that. And I think for me, it's sort of, where's the evidence in the play of it? It is something we could play and is a choice that some directors make, actually. I always look for, like, where do we see that in the play? Because I'm looking for the evidence all of the time. But again, it could be an interesting way to play it.
Josh?
Like Carmen was just saying, Shakespeare gives you everything that you need for the story and to, you know, play the characters for, you know, however many hours you're looking at them in the text. That question, that query, that possibility is something that I think would be really useful for an actor to think about and know and decide for themselves. There is a line that he has to Gertrude in the closet scene where he's very forward about that relationship. Nay, but to live in the rank sweat of an ensemed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over the nasty sty. So yeah, Hamlet's...
There's your evidence, Carmen.
Hamlet's thoughts about that are not very positive.
Yeah, and, you know, one of your first monologues in the play is, you know, you talk about your mother laying in incestuous sheets.
Right, right, right.
I mean, yeah. There's a lot of other ways you could have said, you know, I'm pissed at you, Mom.
So we know what Hamlet thinks about it, but I meant in terms of, you know,
why
Gertrude falls for Claudius. You know, that's not something that Shakespeare tells us. It's something that we've got to wonder at, and that definitely the actress needs to infer and assume for herself.
Anybody else?
It seems to me that there's an interesting transfer that takes place after you talk with your father's ghost, and he says, don't blame your mother. It seems like all of your rage gets transferred onto Ophelia at that point, because that's the point at which you really start to lay in. You're not very nice to her a lot, but there are many times where after that where you're even more full of rage at her. Does that explain the kind of bloodless nature of your two childhood friends, you know, your reaction to them betraying you as opposed to your thought that Ophelia betrayed you?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that it's transferred immediately to Ophelia. The betrayal doesn't actually occur until just prior to the Get Thee to a Nunnery scene where she brings the love letters that I had written her and says, here, take these back. And in that instance, Hamlet is aware, I think, that he's being observed by Claudius and Polonius, and that Ophelia is being used in this instance. So at that moment, the betrayal is not only by his uncle and Polonius as his cohort, but it's also by this woman that he loves and trusts and would lay down his life for. And now either by her choice or because she is too naive and easily swayed by her father, is doing their will and turning on Hamlet. And so, yeah, there is rage at the situation, but that rage, which is immediately felt, has to find a vent, and she's the only one there at that point.
Carmen, the language, get thee to a nunnery, you know, get away.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if that comes from rejection and anger, or I wondered if maybe that was an act of love and protectiveness of her.
Of him to her.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Both.
It is, yeah. I mean, I agree with everything that Josh is saying, but in a way, he has to push her away to protect her and to keep his own secret. You know, as soon as he learns that she's giving back the letters and that the father's there, he puts on his crazy mask again. I think it's a way of loving her and pushing her away and protecting her. Get thee to a nunnery, go to a convent and be safe.
Yeah, because at that moment, he can't say, like, Ophelia, why are you doing this? Ophelia, here's my plan. Ophelia, you know, here's how I really feel. Because if he gives that to her, then Claudius and Polonius will eventually wheedle it out of her. So he's got to play the game. Hamlet's relationship to Ophelia is written in letters that are displayed for the king and queen by Polonius. Hamlet makes all of these proclamations of love, of his devotion to her. And when Gertrude does lay flowers on Ophelia's grave, she says, man, I wish that these were for your marriage bed and not your grave. So I think that that's totally where the relationship was headed. It was headed towards a lasting union.
I think that speaks to Hamlet's relationship, Josh's relationship with Ophelia.
Oh, man, you're making me so confused, Doctor.
if we go in that direction, I actually will have to charge you.
Fair enough.
I used to think in high school when I read this play that Ophelia just went mad and crazy. Since then, I've lost my father. I feel now Ophelia doesn't just go crazy, but it's more that she's trying to fill the void of that grief that's left when you lose a parent. And I wondered if you could speak on that, if you feel like that's that grief just kind of getting a little crazy, but you haven't exactly gone mad.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, when we were rehearsing, I talked to Ophelia about her. She's holding her life. It's like a delicate paper bowl or lantern, and that it's about to break and it's about to tear apart. And she has to do everything she can to stop the kind of tsunami of emotion from overwhelming her. And so she turns to these silly songs that she sings to keep it at bay. And she reenacts the father's burial. And she's got all these flowers that she's giving out. And I think all of her actions are to just keep it at bay. And it's so overwhelming that if she let a real thought come in, she would be, I don't know what would happen. But she ends up drowning herself. So clearly she's, can't cope with it.
May I ask you a question about Hamlet here?
Sure.
At the very end, when he dies, he's at peace. Maybe that's my takeaway. He seems to be okay with dying.
Hmm.
Are you?
Honestly, it depends on the night.
Hmm.
Textually, it's he has a speech where just before the fight, he says the readiness is all, and I think that in that line he's ready for whatever happens. And I think there is, for me as director, there is some at peace with it.
He's not quite ready. He knows that he needs to make himself ready, because the first thing that he does in that following scene is he asks forgiveness of Laertes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely going into that last scene, I'm like, all right, if I'm going to die, I've got some things that I need to make right. So, like, that's the first thing he does. He's like, all right, please don't hold this sin that I've committed against you against me. He ultimately winds up killing Claudius and, you know, fulfilling the mandate that, you know, his ghostly father gave to him. So, like, yeah, he's like, my mission is accomplished. But then there's that moment of, like, him talking with Horatio and saying, like, all right, the end is coming. Like, tell my story, but tell it right. And when you sit there and you have to act as though you are dying, you start to, you know, contemplate these things. So sometimes it's like, all right, mission is complete. I have, you know, no more to say. Here comes the end. Let it be. And then other times, you know, those words from to be or not to be come back. And it's like, oh man, where am I going? What's going to happen now? Oh no, here it comes and I don't have a choice. It's over.
I also want to add a very human element here where you say, tell my story. I'm dying, tell it right. Hmm. And I encourage my patients and my students to do the same thing. Tell your story and tell it right. Hmm. We always learn something from that. Yeah. No matter, and it's going to change year by year. We have time for one more question.
So we keep talking about betrayal and this huge theme of betrayal. Kind of at every step of the way, you're betrayed by, you know, your mother and your uncle, your childhood friends, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and then, you know, the woman you love who, you wanted to marry, you know, the kind of the final nail in the coffin, so to speak. So how do you think that has impacted Hamlet's relationship with Horatio? Do you think that has cast any doubt in his trust for Horatio? Or do you think it's only strengthened the relationship because now this is the last and only person who he can truly confide in at the end?
Wow.
Yeah.
I definitely think that it is a strengthening factor. I think that Hamlet continues to give people the benefit of the doubt until they prove themselves unworthy of his trust. And Horatio never breaks Hamlet's trust. And I think that the more other people in Hamlet's life that do turn on him, that do betray him, the more valuable Horatio's loyalty becomes.
Let me ask you about Josh. Is Josh the same way?
I think so.
Yes.
Final thoughts, Carmen?
It never, ever ceases to be fascinating exploring Shakespeare's works. And even after the sixth time of getting into Hamlet, I still feel like I'm a student again. I'm still learning. He's the great teacher.
Yeah, how fortunate you are. Mm. Josh?
You know, this is the kind of stuff that I, as an actor, live for, like getting to really dig into characters and figuring out what makes them tick and how to play them on stage. So having an opportunity to psychoanalyze Hamlet as Hamlet is something I wouldn't trade for the world, no.
I love this guy. Hamlet, final thoughts?
Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wan, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing.
Thank you both so very much, and thank you.
Thank you.
To our studio audience for your interesting question.
This has been a Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guest Carmen Kahn, founder and artistic director of the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater, and Josh Kaknich of The Troupe, appearing as himself and as Hamlet. If you'd like to be part of our live audience at our next taping, keep an eye on the WHYY events page for more information. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. We'd love to hear from you. More from today's show on our website, whyy.org/voices. The engineers for today's show were Adam Staniszewski and Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of WHYY audio content. I'm Larry Roebling, writer and producer of Voices in the Family. Dr. Dan Gottlieb is the host.
Have a good week, my friends. And the week after that. And the week after that. And the week after that.